The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from the issue dated October 21st, 2011. From the main story section, our first item, the swelling protests against Wall Street. What happened? The Occupy Wall Street protest movement continued to gain momentum this week, with demonstrations growing in dozens of cities across the country. In New York City, where the protest began a month ago, hundreds of demonstrators set out from their camp in the financial district and marched through some of Manhattan's toniest neighborhoods. They paused outside the homes of media mogul Rupert Murdoch, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, and industrialist David Koch, chanting, "We are the 99%, reflecting the demonstrators' view that the wealthiest 1% are getting rich at the expense of everyone else. "I have nothing against these people personally," said protester Michael Pollack. "I just think they should pay their fair share of taxes." In Washington, six protesters were arrested after their group marched into a Senate office building shouting anti-corporate slogans, and more than 100 people were arrested in Boston after protesters tried to set up camp in a downtown park. As the demonstrations enter their fourth week, politicians in Washington began weighing in. President Obama said the protests reflected the frustrations many ordinary Americans feel toward top bankers who caused the recession but escaped punishment. Leading Republicans, meanwhile, offered fierce condemnations of the protesters. Eric Cantor, the Republican House Majority Leader, denounced them as a dangerous growing mob, while Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain argued they were simply jealous anti-capitalists. "Don't blame Wall Street," he said. "If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself." What the editorial said: "The protesters are justifiably angry," said the New York Times. "The share of income held by the richest 1% of households now sits at around 23%, the highest since 1928. Meanwhile, middle class and poor families have seen their earnings plummet over the past decade. Studies show that such extreme inequality causes a host of ills, from poorer public health to lower levels of educational attainment. And it also skews political power, as policy invariably reflects the interests of wealthy Americans. This left-leaning crowd would be better off raging against their own machine," said the Wall Street Journal. Their political favorites ran all Washington until January, but Obama simply prolonged the recession by hitting businesses with a barrage of regulations. "We sympathize with their frustration at the sad economic results of all this, but if they really want to revive the economy, they might try joining the Tea Party." Now here's what the commentators said. "We should heed the demonstrators' message," said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. "The massive concentration of wealth at the top is undermining our social and political order, as much of it was unfairly accumulated through accounting chicanery, crony capitalism, and a K Street fix. Calling for this gross inequality to be addressed doesn't make the protesters socialists. They're merely pointing out the social evils wrought by capitalism unchecked by government." "But which inequalities do the Occupy Wall Street crowd want to tackle?" asked Victor Davis Hansen in NationalReview.com. "The fact that a municipal worker makes $30,000 a year, while liberal darlings like Matt Damon and Johnny Depp extort $20 million for a month's work, that John Kerry owns a multi-million dollar sailboat? Or do they only get angry when Republican voting businessmen make large sums of money? The simple truth is that lambasting the richest 1% won't fix our problem, said David Brooks in the New York Times. During the boom years, the supposedly virtuous 99% overconsumed and overborrowed. Even if we tax away 50% of the income of those making between $1 million and $10 million, we'll only reduce the national debt by 1%. Escaping the current economic malaise requires all of society to work together. That's why the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street should join forces, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. Both groups regard the nexus of big finance and big government as irredeemably corrupt. While they disagree about the size of the government, together they could prevent Wall Street execs and co-opted bureaucrats from capturing money that could be spent on tax cuts or infrastructure. As yet, though, Occupy Wall Street protesters still think of Tea Partiers as crypto-fascists, while pundits on the right dismiss anyone with a union card, a nose ring, and an iPad. Unless those attitudes change, the establishment is going to win again. The next item from the Week magazine, Romney dominates. Mitt Romney solidified his status this week as the candidate to beat in the race for the Republican presidential nomination. The former Massachusetts governor dominated Tuesday's debate and picked up valuable endorsement from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a favorite of the Republican establishment. Romney was widely considered the winner of the New Hampshire debate, which focused on the economy after giving another solid professional performance. Herman Cain, the former Godfather's Pizza executive, currently in second place, was also judged to have done well, despite being forced to defend the details of his 999 economic plan, which calls for 9% business, income, and national sales taxes. Former frontrunner Rick Perry gave another weak performance, analysts said, after slumping into third place in the polls. Debates are not my strong suit, he told reporters. That's an understatement, said Steve Carnacki in Salon.com. The stakes were high for Perry going into this debate. Conservatives still seek someone to deliver them from the inevitability of Romney, and after three lackluster debates, this was Perry's chance to step up. He failed. All he could muster were dull, vague responses to questions on the economy, revealing a staggering lack of preparation. Someone may yet challenge Romney's primacy in this race, but after his showing this week, it won't be Perry. Don't look to Herman Cain either, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. The Tea Party favorite was as amiable as ever during the debate, but failed to answer the serious questions about his 999 tax plan, which the GOP's anti-tax lobby dislikes and economists say is unworkable. Unless Cain proves 999 is more than just a catchy slogan, he'll remain a one-note wonder. Romney is now the only remotely plausible candidate for the nomination, said John Potthartz in the New York Post. That's partly because of the failure of his rivals, but also because he's been running for president almost nonstop for 5 years now and has learned how the game works. Conservatives still question his fidelity to ideological principle, but with 3 months to go until the first caucuses, there's a growing suspicion that he's going to have to do it. Our next item, an Iranian terror plot. The U.S. stepped up sanctions on Iran this week after accusing it of hatching a bizarre plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador on U.S. soil. Attorney General Eric Holder said the Iranians plan to kill Saudi envoy Adel al-Jubeir by bombing a crowded restaurant in Washington, D.C., causing the deaths of scores of others. Authorities uncovered the scheme when Iranian-American Mansour Arabsara hired a Mexican hitman who was an informant of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Arabsara, 56, was arrested September 29th in New York City and later implicated Iranian officials, including a cousin in Iran's elite Quds Force, which reports directly to Iran's supreme commander. Iran denied the charges. The U.S. government and the CIA have very good experience in making up film scripts, said presidential spokesman Ali Abkar Javanfair. This plot comes so far out of left field that it doesn't make sense, said Max Fisher in TheAtlantic.com. Why would Iran kill the Saudi ambassador, an act that would only bring the U.S. and Saudi Arabia closer together? Why use a Mexican drug cartel? According to the indictment, a member of the Quds force wired almost $100,000 into the U.S. for the hit. Does that sound like an intel service to you? Don't be too surprised, said Kenneth Pollack in TheDailyBeast.com. Iran has been markedly more aggressive in the past 2 years, ramping up support for radical Shiite groups in Iraq and arming the Taliban in Afghanistan. This plot, if true, means that Iran is now willing to go way beyond anything it has ever done before to strike blows against the United States, and that it no longer fears U.S. military retaliation. Iran obviously sees itself as at war with the U.S., said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. When a U.S. informant said the assassination would cause mass U.S. casualties, Abbasir allegedly replied, they want that guy done. If the 100 go with him, F them. Iran has far greater resources than al-Qaeda ever did, and now it is ready to use them to commit terrorist acts on U.S. soil. It's past time for U.S. policy toward Iran to reflect the reality of what it is dealing with. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week, entitled Obama's Jobs Bill. Is it dead or more alive than ever? Barack Obama's dimming prospects for re-election just got worse, said Patricia Murphy in TheDailyBeast.com. The $447 billion jobs bill he proposed to ward off a double-dip recession hit a major roadblock this past week when Senate Republicans, with the help of two Democratic defectors, blocked it from even coming to an up or down vote. The bill would impose a 5.6% surtax on annual income over $1 million and pump money into the stagnant economy through payroll tax cuts, infrastructure spending, and aid to save the jobs of teachers, police, and other public workers. The Republicans' unified opposition meant the chances of passage were always slim. But the White House still sees the bill as a wedge issue in the 2012 election, offering hard proof that Obama is doing more to revive the economy than the do-nothing Republicans in Congress. Obama will now break his bill into pieces and resubmit them to both houses of Congress. If Republicans continue to block his proposals, he'll frame the campaign as a choice between a party that's trying to help the middle class and one that cares only about the rich. That's a smart political strategy, and it's true, said Steve Bannon in WashingtonMonthly.com. Leading economists predicted that the president's plan would have added 1.9 million jobs, raised economic output by 2 percentage points, and lowered the unemployment rate to 8%. The bill included Republican-supported tax credits for business, an extension of the payroll tax, and other bipartisan proposals with wide voter support. So why have Republicans opposed it from the start? It will now be obvious to voters that the GOP is determined to keep the economy weak for the express purpose of undermining the Obama presidency. This job bill deserves to die, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. It's a poorly conceived, politically motivated stink bomb designed to turn Americans against one another and stoke up feelings of envy, grievances, and rage. Democrats will now cynically use this vote as a centerpiece in the president's re-election campaign. Yet, on its merits, the bill is nothing more than a second attempt at failed economic stimulus. Its central feature, a temporary payroll tax cut, was already tried, and it failed to produce jobs. Even worse, the spending would be financed with a permanent half-trillion-dollar tax hike on wealthy job creators, further diminishing chances of an economic recovery. There are so many glaring problems with this flawed bill, said Steve Huntley in SunTimes.com, that voters see it for what it is, politicking. People like politicking for the right cause, said J. Newton Small in Time.com. Americans favor putting teachers and cops back to work. More than two-thirds of them, including a majority of Republicans, favor taxing the rich to close the deficit, according to a new Bloomberg poll. For the Democrats, this confrontation over the jobs bill may prove to be electoral gold. Yet they will need to spend it wisely, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Voters are despondent about the economy and fed up with politicians. That's especially true of independents who helped elect Obama in 2008, but now strongly favor Romney, according to a recent Pew poll. The president may wish to run, Truman-like, against a hostile Congress. But to win re-election, he must convince those skeptical swing voters that his solutions to our fiscal problems are better than his opponents. Even if it's true, that will be a very hard sell. And now we'll turn to the popular column from The Week magazine entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for taking it all in stride. After Lexington, Kentucky mocked its selection by Men's Health magazine as the country's least active city, by staging a sedentary parade, Mayor Jim Gray rode on a motorized couch with his feet up on a table as residents looked on from lawn chairs. It was a good week for Knitcraft, a high-end knitwear company in Winona, Minnesota, as sales of its black turtlenecks soared after Steve Jobs' death. Jobs wore the turtlenecks almost every day. And it was a good week for job creation after the Florida legislature began considering a repeal of the state's ban on dwarf tossing, a bar game in which patrons hurl dwarfs onto mattresses. All the ban does is prevent some dwarfs from getting jobs they would be happy to get, said State Representative Rich Workman. And it was a bad week for true love after Columbia University researchers found that single women consider overweight men more attractive if they are wealthy. For each 10% increase in body mass index, a single man must get a 2% raise in salary to stay in the same dating pool. It was a bad week for Big Ben after a new report revealed that the iconic clock tower in London is leaning 0.26 degrees. That leaves the top out of alignment by some 18 inches, which is visible to the naked eye. And it was a bad week for the Westboro Baptist Church after the radical church said Steve Jobs was going to hell and called for a protest at his funeral. At the bottom of the church's tweeted call for a protest, it said, via Twitter or iPhone. The church later explained that God created the iPhone, not Steve Jobs. And now we'll turn to the People's section in The Week magazine for this week. Our first item is called Love's Losses. Courtney Love hasn't forgiven Kurt Cobain, said Nancy Jo Sales in Vanity Fair. If he came back right now, I'd have to kill him for what he did to us. Love says of her husband, who committed suicide in 1994, I'd kill him, and then I'd kill him again. Love says that the Nirvana frontman's death wasn't a surprise. He tried to kill himself three times, and then there were the drugs. He OD'd at least five times. I carried around Narcan, she says, referring to a drug used to revive heroin users after an overdose. Love's relationship with her daughter, Frances Bean Cobain, was also ruined by substance abuse. Frances was placed in protective custody at birth. There were no drugs in my urine, no drugs in her urine when she was born, Love insists. She bemoans her parenting failures, which led to Frances's inability to read until she was seven. It was my fault. I never read to her. Frances, who is now 19, legally emancipated herself from her mother 2 years ago, a decision that still hurts and bewilders love. "All I can feel is how much I love her," she says. "I'd give anything to hear the sound of her heels walking down the hall past my bedroom." The next item is entitled "A Miserable Wild Thing." "Maury Sendak is a grumpy old man," said Tim Tiemann in the London Times. The author of the famed children's book Where the Wild Things Are is now 83, lives alone in rural Connecticut, and walks with a stick. "It's for hitting people," he says. His partner of 50 years, psychoanalyst Eugene Glenn, died of cancer in 2007. "I dream of him constantly. I'm always feeling that I didn't do enough for him." After 4 years of living alone, he longs for someone to make love to. "My body so much wants that comfort, but as you get older and older, you realize it's not acceptable. You learn to live with it." Sendak still writes and keeps himself occupied tutoring summer students. "I don't know how to tell them the truth. It's a waste of time. Publishing is vulgar and cheap, and they won't make a living." He rarely feels happy. "Who's happy? What does that mean? I'm nothing to be happy about. The whole world stinks. Everything is decaying. The lack of culture depresses me most." Sendak claims that he's looking forward to his death. "It's time to go. It's time to get out. It really is," he says. "I will be nothing and nowhere, and that will be such a relief. To be something and somewhere is very tiring. The good times are so few." Those are the words of Maury Sendak, the author of Where the Wild Things Are. The next item, McGregor's naked ambition. "Ewan McGregor likes getting nude and rude," says Sanjeev Bhattacharya in the London Observer, although he's best known for playing Obi-Wan Kenobi in the kid-friendly Star Wars series. The Scottish actor has spent much of his career half or entirely naked. The 40-year-old memorably stripped down in Velvet Goldmine, Train Spotting, and The Pillow book, throughout which he hardly wore a stitch. Regarding his much-flaunted equipment, he says it's got a great career. It's got its own Facebook page and Twitter account and everything. This lack of inhibition has occasionally caused him trouble. McGregor recalls the time he starred in Joe Orton's play What the Butler Saw at a feisty English theater. "I had to stand up naked from behind a sofa and grab a policeman's helmet to cover myself and dash across the stage," he says. "One day I let the helmet go just for effect. The audience gasped. I loved it. I felt very powerful in that moment, and so I kept doing it. But during one performance, someone spilled water on stage. I slipped and landed on my back. I was sliding with my legs up, arse first, right into the front row." And Paul McCartney walked down the aisle for a third time this past week, marrying New York businesswoman Nancy Chevelle in a low-key ceremony in London. The former Beatles, 69, and his 51-year-old bride tied the knot in the old Marylebone Town Hall where he married his first wife, Linda, in 1969. Guests included McCartney's former bandmate Ringo Starr and Chevelle's cousin, Barbara Walters. "The newlyweds toasted their union with a party at McCartney's home," said People.com, where guests enjoyed a vegetarian feast of goat cheese polenta, arugula salad, and vegan wedding cake. The pair are planning a New York celebration later this month. Now we'll turn to the briefing from the Week magazine for this week. And this particular item is entitled Cleaning Up Space. "The Earth is surrounded by an ever-growing cloud of space junk. Is it too late to take out the extraterrestrial trash? How much junk is up there?" Well, since the space age began with the launch of Sputnik 54 years ago, we've turned the region just above Earth's atmosphere into a giant scrapyard, littered with everything from exploded rockets to tools lost during spacewalks. The U.S. Space Surveillance Network is currently tracking some 22,000 pieces of orbital trash that are at least 4 inches across. NASA estimates that tens of millions of smaller non-trackable objects are circling the Earth, such as screws and flecks of spacecraft paint. It can take centuries, but everything that goes up comes down. Smaller trash burns up on re-entry. Larger objects can reach the ground. That was the case last month when a 6-ton NASA satellite made a fiery descent through the atmosphere and splashed into the Pacific Ocean. With more and more countries lobbing satellites into space, Earth's orbit is filling up with waste faster than gravity can empty it. The problem is worse now than it was 10 years ago, says NASA engineer Leroy Kane. In 10 years, it will be worse still. Even if humanity never sends up another rocket, the number of stray objects will continue to climb. Why might that happen? There's so much debris in orbit, says the National Research Council in a recent study, that it could set off a collision cascade, an unending chain reaction, in which pieces of junk collide and create more debris, which in turn causes more collisions and debris. This runaway process could create a clutter barrier in space that would make it difficult to operate the satellites that enable our communications, meteorological and GPS systems. We've lost control of the environment, says retired NASA scientist Donald Kessler, who wrote the NRC study. What makes the junk a hazard? Most space debris flies at or near an orbital velocity of 17,500 miles per hour. At that speed, even a tiny bolt can cause massive damage. If one collides with a satellite or another piece of debris at the not unreasonable relative velocity of, say, 5 miles per second, it will blow it to smithereens, says NASA engineer Creon Levitt. The International Space Station has been fitted with more than 100 shields made from layers of aluminum, ceramic, and Kevlar fiber that can withstand strikes from objects measuring 0.4 inches and smaller. But in April, the ISS had to maneuver to avoid a large piece of debris, the fifth time since 2008 it was forced to do so. 2 months later, the six-man crew rushed to their Soyuz escape pods when a small hunk of junk hurled toward the station. The debris passed within 1,100 feet of the station, its closest shave yet. Other satellites make maneuvers almost daily to avoid collisions, costing them precious fuel and shortening their lifespans. Can't we stop the buildup? In 1981, NASA tweaked the design of its rockets so they would no longer explode into hundreds of pieces after delivering payloads into orbit. The Europeans, Russians, and Chinese followed suit over the next decade, and it appeared as though the space junk problem had been largely contained. That all changed in 2007, when China blasted apart a defunct weather satellite with a missile, creating 150,000 new pieces of debris, 3,100 of which are large enough to be tracked from the ground. Then in 2009, the retired Russian communications satellite Cosmos 2251 smashed into a working satellite owned by the U.S. firm Iridium. The collision created another 2,000 big chunks of orbiting scrap. Those two single events doubled the amount of fragments in Earth orbit and completely wiped out what we had done in the last 25 years, says Kessler. Is it possible to remove the junk? The U.S. Air Force is developing a $1 billion space fence radar system to track debris as small as 0.4 inches and supply advance warnings to satellite operators. But there's a growing consensus that monitoring the problem isn't enough. Someone needs to take out the trash. The European Space Agency has suggested sending up a probe to spray old boosters and satellites with expanding foam. The foam would increase the junk's atmospheric drag, ensuring a quicker re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. ESA scientists say their plan could remove the 50 largest pieces of junk within 30 years. NASA, meanwhile, has suggested using Earth-based lasers to nudge large pieces of space junk off collision courses. When will the cleanup start? At the moment, all the junk-busting gadgets are still doodles on the drawing board, but even if we had the technology at hand, no nation has the legal right to launch a mass cleanup of space. You can't take, touch, or salvage space objects from another country, says Joanne Gabrinowitz, a space law expert at the University of Mississippi. That's a big problem, since only 29% of the clutter is American, while 37% is Russian and 28% Chinese. The international community isn't likely to resolve this legal quandary anytime soon. The UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space are still arguing about where space begins, says Victoria Sampson of the Secure World Foundation, a lobbying group. That's the same argument they've been having for 40 years. And the footnote to Cleaning Up Space, this article in the briefing this week, getting hit by falling garbage. NASA estimates that at least one piece of trash hits the Earth's surface every day, but only one person is known to have ever been struck. Lonnie Williams was strolling in a Tulsa park in 1997 when she saw a fiery streak in the sky and felt something tap her on the shoulder. It turned out to be a metal strip from a Delta II rocket, about the weight of an empty soda can, she says. So don't panic next time a satellite re-enters the atmosphere. The European Space Agency estimates that in the course of a typical 75-year lifetime, the risk of being injured by space junk is less than 1 in a billion. In comparison, the lifetime risk of being struck by lightning is around 1 in 80,000. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We're going to turn now to the best columns in the U.S. as reported this week in the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Reagan Was No Genial Moderate, by Stephen F. Hayward in Commentary. It's pretty hard to believe, but liberals suddenly love Ronald Reagan, said Stephen Hayward. It's now common to hear liberal pundits and President Barack Obama express wistful fondness for Reagan as a congenial, pragmatic compromiser who didn't let ideology get in the way of governing. This revisionist view of Reagan is entirely false. Reagan was a true small government conservative who heavily cut income taxes by 23% across the board. When he did agree to raise taxes 2 years later, he stood his ground on his new tax rates, agreeing only to new excise hikes on cigarettes and phone calls and the reduction of tax credits and deductions. As for his supposedly pleasant, non-ideological nature, Reagan was not merely disliked by the left during his presidency, but loathed. One Democratic congressman accused Reagan of promoting fascist precepts lifted verbatim from Mein Kampf. House Speaker Tip O'Neill called Reagan evil and mean, with ice water for blood. Political cartoonists and pundits portrayed Reagan as a reactionary, witless doofus. So please, no more liberal revisionism. Reagan was a conservative warrior, not a malleable moderate. The next item, Feeling Free to Hate Mormons, by James Follows in TheAtlantic.com. I am no big fan of Mitt Romney, says James Follows, but to oppose his presidential bid simply because of his religion is just plain bigotry. At last week's Values Voters Summit, Texas evangelical preacher Robert Jeffress, who backs Rick Perry, reiterated his view that Mormons aren't Christians and that voting for a Mormon like Romney would give credibility to a cult. Media coverage of the Mormon angle focused on whether widespread antipathy toward the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will affect Romney's chances. But that's how Jeffress' bigot talk would be covered if he said, I'd never trust a Jew, or a black could never do the job, or women should stay in their place. Such sentiments would inspire universal outrage, yet it remains acceptable for people on both the right and left to be open about their anti-Mormonism. For evangelicals, it's the church's theology that's the problem. For liberals, it's the LDS's conservative political stances. Either way, disdaining all Mormons is simply prejudice, no better than hating all Catholics or Jews or blacks. The next column is entitled, The Mandate is No Such Thing, by William Leach in the Los Angeles Times. Why the big fuss over the individual mandate? Asked William Leach. Under President Obama's health care law, Americans must have health insurance or pay a tax penalty. Critics insist this so-called mandate is unconstitutional and represents a huge encroachment into Americans' lives. But the word mandate is a misnomer. No one gets carted off to jail if they fail to buy insurance. Instead, people who choose not to purchase health insurance, thereby becoming free riders on the health care system, will pay about $695 in additional federal taxes. What's so shocking about that? It's entirely commonplace for the government to use the tax code to reward or penalize people for their marketplace decisions. Americans who buy their own homes get a big tax break, for example, while those who rent are in effect penalized for choosing not to buy. A taxpayer is rewarded for buying hybrid cars, having children, and making charitable contributions. He's heavily taxed for smoking or buying gasoline. Are these mandates? No. People who don't purchase health insurance impose unfair costs on the rest of us, and the new law simply taxes them for this selfish choice. And now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine for this week to the section entitled The Last Word. And this week, the article is entitled When Dreams Kill. The mind is so powerful that Alexis Madrigal, that it can make us sick and it can even cause our own death. They died in their sleep, one by one, thousands of miles from home. Their median age was 33. All but one, 116 of the 117, were healthy men, immigrants from Southeast Asia. You could count the time most had spent on American soil in just months. At the peak of the deaths in the early 1980s, the death rate from this mysterious problem among the Hmong ethnic group was equivalent to the top five natural causes of death for other American men in their age group. Something was killing Hmong men in their sleep, and no one could figure out what it was. There was no obvious cause of death. None of them had been sick physically. The men weren't clustered all that tightly, geographically speaking. They were united by dislocation from Laos and a shared culture, but little else. Even Dr. House would have been stumped. Doctors gave the problem a name, the kind that reeks of defeat, a dragon label on the edge of the known medical world, sudden, unexpected, nocturnal death syndrome, SUNDS, SUNS. It didn't do much in terms of diagnosis or treatment, but it was easier to track the periodic conferences dedicated to understanding the problem. 25 years later, Shelley Adler's new book pieces together what happened, drawing on interviews with the Hmong population and analyzing the extant scientific literature. Sleep paralysis, nightmares, nocebos, and the mind-body connection is a mind-bending exploration of how what you believe interacts with how your body works. Adler, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, comes to a stunning conclusion. In a sense, the Hmong were killed by their beliefs in the spirit world, even if the mechanism of their deaths was likely an obscure genetic cardiac arrhythmia that is prevalent in Southeast Asia. By 1986, the Hmong deaths had slowed, but they remained a striking epidemiological fact. Shelley Adler was a graduate student at UCLA studying traditional belief narratives at the time. She'd been researching what she called nocturnal pressing spirit attacks, or what scientific literature called sleep paralysis. Fascinatingly, sleep paralysis is known to just about all cultures, and it is almost always associated with nocturnal evil. In Indonesia, it's called Dijuntan. In China, it's Beigia. The Hungarians know it as Bozsarkány Nyomás, which is pressure. In Newfoundland, the spirit that comes is called the old hag, and the experience of sleep paralysis, agrog, hag-ridden. The Dutch name comes closest to what English speakers know. They call the presence Nachtmerrie, the nightmare. The mare in question comes from the German M-A-R-H-R, mare, or Old Norse Mara, which denoted a generally female supernatural being who, in Adler's words, lay on people's chests, suffocating them. Across cultures, nightmare visits play out in very similar ways. Victims experience the strange feeling of being awake. While they have a realistic perception of their environment, they can't move. Worse, they feel an overwhelming fear and dread accompanied by chest pressure and difficulty breathing. Scientists have a pretty good grasp of how all this happens. The paralysis, the feeling of pressure on the chest, all that is explained quite nicely within the scientific models of sleep. During sleep paralysis, a person experiences an out-of-sequence REM state. In REM sleep, we dream and our minds shut off the physical control of the body. We're supposed to be temporarily paralyzed, but we are not supposed to be conscious in REM sleep. Yet that is precisely what happens during sleep paralysis. It's a mix of brain states that are normally separate. And then there is this weird stuff, the old hag part, the nightmare. People who have an experience of sleep paralysis tend to feel some horrible, evil being is near them. I just knew this presence was there, an ominous presence. Not only could I not see it, but I couldn't defend myself. I couldn't do anything, one victim told Adler. This feeling is consistent across cultures, even if it goes by different names and presents through the culture one knows. I experienced sleep paralysis twice in college. I can vouch for the sheer terror that attends the experience. I saw, no, felt, an evil presence to my left. I can't tell you what was evil about it or how I knew it was so nasty, but I did. As the experience progressed, it came closer. It didn't feel like my life was at risk. That was, in fact, too small. It felt like the presence was after something else, probably what you'd call my soul or my being, even though intellectually I'm a straight materialist. I woke up more scared than I'd ever been in my life. But there's one big difference between sleep paralysis, which impacts a substantial percentage of the global population at least once, and what the Hmong immigrants experienced in the 1980s. The old hag was terrifying but harmless. Whatever happened in the night to the Hmong killed them. Adler studied the Hmong and their relationship to what they call Tusog Tusom for years and years. That research forms the core of her book. Adler went out into the field. She collected dozens of experiences of sleep paralysis among the Hmong, both from their own interviews and other researchers. One 49-year-old Adler interviewed provided this typical experience. I remember a few months after I first came here, I was asleep. I turned out the light and everything, but I kind of think, and then all of a sudden I felt that I cannot move. I just feel it, but I don't see anything. Then I tried to move my hand, but I cannot move my hand. I keep trying, but I cannot move myself. I know it is Sog Suom. I am so scared I can hardly breathe. I think, who will help? What if I die? She brought her background in exploring traditional belief systems to bear on attacks like the one above. She found that the nighttime attacks were part of a matrix of beliefs held by both animist and Christian Hmong. A powerful folklore had built up around Tusog Tusom. I'm going to spell that for you. It's T-S-O-G-T-S-U-A-M. Tusog Tusom. Not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Anyway, that included both causes and cures for the attacks. When the Hmong don't worship properly, do not perform the religious ritual properly, or forget to sacrifice or whatever, then the ancestor spirits or the village spirits do not want to guard them, one man explained to Adler. That's why the evil spirit is able to come and get them. And for a lot of reasons, the Hmong in the late 1970s and early 1980s were not able to worship properly. The ethnic group fought a guerrilla war against the government of Laos with the U.S. backing during the Vietnam War. When the Laotian communists won, many Hmong struck out for America to avoid reprisals. The U.S. government decided to scatter the Hmong randomly across the U.S. to 53 different cities, breaking up the immigration patterns we generally see. In short order, the Hmong organized and made a secondary migration to California, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Unemployment was obscenely high, and the sense of community that many had enjoyed in the old country was gone. Some Hmong felt they had not properly honored the memories of their ancestors, which was a known risk factor among the Hmong for being visited by the Sog Suom. Once the nightmare visitations began, a shaman was often needed to set things right. And in the scattered communities of Hmong across the country, they might not have access to the right person. Drawing on all this evidence, Adler makes the provocative claim that the Laotian immigrants of the 1980s were in some sense killed by their powerful cultural belief in night spirits, that the solitary Hmong man confronted by the numinous terror of the nightmare and aware of its murderous intent can die of SUNDS, S-U-N-D-S, and that is Sudden Unexpected Nocturnal Death Syndrome. Her argument amounts to a stirring and chilling case for the power of the nocebo, the flip side of the placebo effect. While placebo studies have grown in importance, the nocebo effect has not been studied well by scientists, in part because of the ethical issues involved in deliberately doing something that might harm people. Limited studies suggest that it is real and it is powerful. For example, doctors have found that patients made to feel anxious need larger amounts of opiates after surgery than other people. They found that pretending to expose people who say they are sensitive to electromagnetic radiation to cell phone signals can give them debilitating headaches. Even patients' levels of side effects from arthritis medication seem determined by those patients' beliefs about those medicines. Logically speaking, if the evidence shows the upside of belief, why wouldn't we believe in the downside, too? And why wouldn't we believe that the intensity of the downside would vary with the intensity of the belief, even if those beliefs were about something unscientific like spirits or astrology? If you're still unsure that the nocebo effect could actually lead to premature death, Adler cites one stunning example of the effect from China. A team of researchers found that Chinese Americans die younger than expected if they have a combination of disease and birth year which Chinese astrology and medicine considers ill-fated. That is to say, if they were born in a year that was astrologically linked to a poor lung health, they would die an average of 5 years earlier than lung-related disease than someone born in some other year with the same disease. Similar effects were not found in the white populations around them, and how much sooner they died depended on the people's strength of commitment to traditional Chinese culture. Think about that for a minute. If you were born under a bad sign, you died 5 years younger from the same diseases as people born under good signs, but only if you believed in Chinese astrology. Results like these seem improbable or anti-reason or something, but Adler's book is an attack on the "oh, come on" form of argument. She uses her understanding of both science and traditional belief structures to argue for what she calls local biology. Since meaning has biological consequences and meanings vary across cultures, biology can operate differently in different contexts, she writes. In other words, biology is local. The same biological processes in different places have different effects on people. The truth is that we don't understand the relationship between belief and biology quite as well as we'd like to think. That's one reason sleep paralysis is so useful as a probe for the boundary of mind and body. The nightmare is a link between our biological and cultural selves. While people of all cultures experience sleep paralysis in similar ways, the specific form and intensity it takes vary by culture, soaking up whatever local spirits or monsters happen to be lurking nearby. And that article was written by Alexis Madrigal in the Atlantic Media Company, as published in Atlantic.com, distributed by Tribune Meeting Media Services. And now we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled, Steve Jobs, Does He Deserve All the Adulation? At Apple stores throughout the country, crowds of grieving fans gathered to share their sadness, leaving behind makeshift shrines of flowers, candles, and photos. Lengthy tributes to a man who changed the world filled newspapers, magazines, and websites, with some pundits comparing him to Edison, Ford, Einstein, and even Gandhi. When the world learned last week that Steve Jobs, the 56-year-old founder and guru of Apple, had lost his long battle with cancer, said William Welch in USA Today, it triggered an outpouring of sadness and reverence, more befitting a rock star than a corporate executive. People reacted as if Elvis had died or John Lennon. That's because Jobs was no ordinary executive, said Farhad Manju in Slate.com. Until he came along, personal computers were wonky devices that users operated by typing in clunky commands. Portable music players were large and ungainly and stored too few songs. And smartphones were perfectly serviceable, but nothing that anyone lined up to buy. Jobs revolutionized them all, replacing them with iMacs and iPods and iPhones and iPads that were both beautiful and an incredible joy to use. Thanks to him, the world is a much different, much better place. Steve Jobs was clearly a genius, said Vito Pilecci in the Ottawa Citizen, but his genius was for marketing, not for invention. He wasn't a true programmer or engineer, and as sleek and elegant as Apple products may be, the truth is they just aren't all that original. There were smartphones long before the iPhone and MP3 players before the iPod, and both the computer mouse and the graphical user interface of the Macintosh operating system were invented by Xerox. Jobs' gift was seeing the potential in those inventions and making everyone else see it too. Jobs was more P.T. Barnum than Thomas Edison, said Jim Pick in the WashingtonTimes.com. He certainly changed the way technology looks and had an uncanny gift for selling the public things that the public didn't yet know it wanted, but he didn't fundamentally change the way things work. There was also a real dark side to the man, said Ryan Tate in Gawker.com. Bad Steve, as employees call Jobs' alter ego, maintained a paranoid Orwellian culture of secrecy at Apple, and in the pursuit of greatness, he cast aside politeness and empathy, bullying and belittling the people under him to their breaking point. When one of Apple's design teams met with him to discuss Mobile Me, a failed collection of internet tools, Jobs browbeat and humiliated them. "You've tarnished Apple's reputation," he screamed. "You should hate each other for having let each other down." Bad Steve also had no time for charity. Despite his $8 billion in personal wealth, and he built iPhones and iPads in sweatshops in the Foxconn factories in China, their armies of workers, some of them below the legal age of 16, assemble the devices in 15-hour shifts, while supervisors monitor their efficiency. At least 14 employees have committed suicide. Jobs created many beautiful objects and made billions for Apple, but he was hardly a saint. "You don't change the world by playing nice," said D.B. Grady in Atlantic.com. Had Jobs not been an iron-fisted visionary, he would have settled for less than perfection, and Apple products would not have been the quasi-magical elegance and beauty that set them apart. Bad Steve's contempt for mediocrity was the extra little something that gave him the edge over his rivals, said Gene Marks in Forbes.com. Jobs had a vision of Apple products as platonic ideals of form and function, and to realize that vision in a world where most people aren't so driven, he sometimes had to be a real jerk. It's that quest for the ideal that is Jobs' greatest legacy, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. What he understood better than anyone is the deep connection between beauty and civilization. By relentlessly, even obsessively, pursuing grace and style, he gave us machines that make the user feel more human, not less so, and helped ensure that the age of information would also be an age of artistry. When Jobs captured in all Apple products was a perfectly secular form of hope, said Andy Crouch in the Wall Street Journal. With the swipe of a finger, the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad all offer users the hope that ordinary and mortal life can be elegant and meaningful. Ask for it, and virtually anything you care to summon will appear in your hand, like magic. How fitting that Jobs chose as his company's logo the apple, the very archetype of fallenness and failure, the bitten fruit, and turned it into a sign of promise and progress. And a couple of short items as we reach the end of our program this week. 10 different potential Republican presidential candidates have at some point finished first in polls of GOP voters this year. Among those who've led in at least one poll, Sarah Palin, Donald Trump, Mike Huckabee, and Rudy Giuliani. The average household wealth of the top 1% in the U.S., including home equity, stocks, and investments, was almost $14 million in 2009. The average wealth for the bottom 80% was $62,900 per year. Wall Street firms and executives have tightened security measures in response to the Occupy Wall Street protests. The New York City Police Department is sending out emails to advise firms like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, where marching protesters are headed, while executives are hiring private security guards. It's fair to say they're concerned, said Richard Planksty of the Kroll security firm. And the federal government has begun selling 14,000 parcels of real estate, including airfields, islands, parks, and buildings, in the hope of raising $22 billion over the next 10 years. Now let's take a look at our poll watch for this week. 75% of 1,000 Protestant pastors who were surveyed say Mormons aren't Christians, including 48% of mainline Protestant pastors. Only 34% of veterans who served after 9/11 say the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been worth fighting. 51% say relying too much on military force creates hatred that leads to more terrorism. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is for a print and visually impaired audience and is available as a podcast right afterwards. So long, till next time.